we also need to keep the passion and the creativity and the stuff that this industry has created with the level of resources that it has is pretty impressive. And so, you know, balancing that, I think, is a real challenge, but also what makes it interesting. This is Ethan Green, and you're listening to the Avalanche Hour podcast.
You're tuned in to another episode of the Avalanche Hour podcast, your source for great conversations within the snow and avalanche community. The Avalanche Hour podcast is proudly presented by Veasan Avalanche Control, safety through innovation. With additional sustaining support from Gordini, we keep you outside longer. And Open Snow. Visit opensnow.com to get started with a free trial and enter the discount code AVALANCHEPODCAST at checkout to receive 30% off your first year of Open Snow All Access. The goal of this podcast is to create a stronger community through the sharing of stories, knowledge, and news amongst people with a curious fascination for avalanches. Additional support for today's episode is provided by Six Point Engineering. Based in Nelson, British Columbia, Greg Johnson and his team merged the disciplines of avalanche risk management with structural and geotechnical engineering. Find out more, explore past projects, and get in touch at sixpointeng.com. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Avalanche Hour podcast. There are plenty of great stories to share in this snow and avalanche community, and we've been dropping episodes almost weekly for your commutes, your workouts, wherever you may be listening to this podcast. And thank you for listening, by the way. We really appreciate it. It's mid-March, and the sun is out in Western North America. At time of recording, today, March 15th, 2024, the entire forecast map on avalanche.ca is rated as high avalanche hazard due to a combination of strong solar input, loading from a recent storm, and a buried persistent weak layer. Much of the forecast map on avalanche.org is rated at considerable avalanche hazard today, with a large swath of Colorado rated at high. Suffice it to say that it sure feels like spring has hit the mountainous west, and the sun and temperatures are working their magic on the winter snowpack. Historically, March accounts for a large proportion of annual avalanche fatalities, so play it safe out there and enjoy the beautiful weather. The mountain community of the Pacific Northwest is currently reeling from the loss of two of its beloved members, Nick Burks and Matt Promomo, who tragically passed in separate accidents. Have a listen to the reissue of Caleb's 2021 conversation with Matt Promomo. It's an awesome episode with stories of guiding, forecasting, and educating in the snowy mountainous west. If you have stories of Nick Burks, please share them with Caleb via theavalanchehourpodcast@gmail.com. Today's interview is a fantastic conversation between Caleb and Ethan Green of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. Ethan is a legend in the North American snow and avalanche community and the director of the CAIC. Without further ado, let's drop in.
Welcome to the show, Ethan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. I'm thrilled to have you on the show. It's November 28th as we're recording this right now. For those listeners who don't know the name Ethan Green, Ethan is a native Coloradan. He lives in Leadville, Colorado. He's done an amazing job of blending theory and practice throughout his career. He has a background as a researcher. He studied meteorology at the University of Utah, and he studied atmospheric science at Colorado State University and has a PhD in geosciences. He's been a ski patroller at Big Sky, an avalanche forecaster at the Utah Avalanche Center, and has been the director of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center since 2005. You know, like just at the recent ISSW, I saw Ethan's name on many papers. That's a theme, it seems like. Ethan is a co-contributor, writer of many scholarly articles on snow, weather, and avalanches. He's an instructor in the avalanche science program at Colorado Mountain College in Leadville. And in 2016, Ethan received the Bernie Kingery Award for sustained career contributions by dedicated avalanche field professionals. Another highlight, it seems like, was being awarded the University of Utah's Distinguished Alumnus Award from the Department of Atmospheric Science. A lot of contributions to the field here, Ethan. You have a lot to be proud of. I was hoping you could kind of recount, kind of dust the cobwebs off and think back to maybe your first season of backcountry skiing or venturing into the winter backcountry environment. Like, what were some early memories for you and some big learning points?
Well, that is a long time ago. And thanks for the introduction. That was a lot. It makes me feel old, I guess. I was fortunate enough to grow up in a family that that skied a lot and skied in the backcountry. And so I actually started skiing in the backcountry before skiing at ski areas. My family would head into Rocky Mountain National Park and the Indian Peaks, in the Front Range of Colorado on, wood skis, as the younger person, kind of the bottom of the economic totem pole. Mine never had metal edges until I was, kind of a late teenager. And we mostly didn't go into avalanche terrain, although, we sort of tiptoed around it, and avalanches were something that we talked about, but it was much more of ski touring. Essentially the kind of winter equivalent of hiking. And so my family would do a lot of trips like that throughout every winter. And that was my introduction. It was much later, really my kind of, mid to late teens that I started actively going into avalanche terrain. I went and spent a couple of years living in Telluride right out of high school. And that's where I really kind of learned about avalanches as a hazard, avalanche safety, and where they happened. And, that's how I sort of got started down this path, was by trial and error in the San Juan Mountains, and fortunately getting some good mentorship from folks that sent me on that path to that long list of experiences that you started with.
Yeah, not the most forgiving snowpack at times in Colorado there. Any kind of like surprises or key learning points that you can recount that helped to shape your career?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there were sort of introductions to avalanches. I guess that sort of shaped my career, but the one that really got me to start being serious about training and trying to understand avalanches, I mean, the training that was available at that time was still fairly sparse, was falling off of a crown. We were skiing in an area and pretty oblivious to what was going on. I went down the slope and it had already avalanched, the day before. But of course, I was not in tune to what was happening in the snowpack and the cycles that the snow was going through, and, fell off a meter and a half crown and, was on the bed surface and able to kind of look around and sort of do a little bit of the postmortem that all of us do as avalanche workers. But the conclusions that I took away from it were not the details of the avalanche, but more, I really am out of my element here and need to learn more about this if I'm going to keep doing this kind of stuff. Mm. So, my first avalanche class was with the International Alpine School, Sandy East, who's still a friend of mine to this day. And they had a cabin kind of at the base of Sneffels that we spent a week in, up in the alpine areas of Yankee Boy Basin, the area between Ouray and Telluride, looking at the snow, trying to start avalanches, and moving through the mountains. And so it was a great learning environment for both learning about avalanches, but just how to move through the mountains was a lot of it as well. So And a good introduction to that. Although I guess I had a couple years into it at that point, but a good introduction to that San Juan snowpack, which, you know, has a lot of facets, a lot of corners on the grains around there.
Yeah, no doubt. So kind of transitioning into your academic career, like what spurred you to start down that path in terms of studying at the University of Utah, and kind of like, how has that paralleled your practitioner career?
Yeah, well, it actually started earlier than that. So I graduated from the University of Utah, but I started at Montana State University. And that was really came from, being a ski bum at Telluride and again, getting some good mentorship that kind of led into learning about avalanches had a pretty technical side to it. I mean, we were pretty much reading out of the 1978 Avalanche Handbook, which is a great resource to this day. And so we were applying that in the field, but also, you know, talking about snow metamorphism and, you know, avalanche formation and release as it was at that point. And so I really got interested in the science of it. And I come from a well-educated family that put a lot of value on that and was not very happy about my decision to be a ski bum. And so I decided that I would to go to school and looked around and decided Montana State was the place I wanted to be. I met Carl Berkland my first semester there. And he was just starting the National Forest Avalanche Center, which was the Southwest Montana Avalanche Center at that point. I think it was his first year as a Forest Service employee. And so I became his intern. Did a lot of field work with the other intern, a guy named Mark Brown, and learned a lot from Carl. Carl encouraged me to start ski patrolling, essentially. So the next year I started working at Big Sky, and I kind of did, I think, 4 or 5 years of working at Big Sky. So I'd go to school in the summer and the fall, and then I would take off the rest of the year and ski patrol. So I was kind of going back and forth. I was in the general studies program because I didn't want to declare a major. And I was taking all of the physics and math for engineering and then taking earth science courses. And so I was kind of straddling those two. And eventually I got to the point where the university told me I had to pick a major, but I didn't really want to go into either one of those two programs. While I was working at Big Sky was very different than it is today. I think when I started, the ski patrol was 14 people. I was young and eager to try to do things and got tasked with forecasting the weather for the ski area, both for the snow safety program, but also for the ski area in general, because there weren't very good weather forecasts at that time. And so I had gotten interested in meteorology kind of along the way. And so I sort of reached this fork in the road where I didn't really want to continue on at Montana State. I was really interested in meteorology, but about the only thing I knew is that it was hard and I wasn't very good at it. And so I started looking around for places where I could transfer and get a meteorology degree, because I felt like that was going to help me further my avalanche career, so to speak. And so I looked at a bunch of different programs around the country, from Hawaii to North Carolina. And I stumbled into John Harrell's office, who's a professor at the University of Utah, and kind of told him my story. And he was like, yeah, we do stuff with snow safety people. You know, like, meteorology is really different, but here's what you can expect here. So he encouraged me to come there, and I did. That's when I really kind of dug into academia, spent 2 years finishing that degree. Essentially,
a lot of work has gone into your understanding of snow and avalanches and weather, I'm sure. Let's talk a little bit about the CAIC. So the Colorado Avalanche Information Center is celebrating its 50th anniversary this season. That's super exciting. And it was started back in 1973 as the Colorado Avalanche Warning Program. I would encourage listeners to go back to episode 5.34. I don't know how I did 34 episodes in a season, but that episode is with Knox Williams. And Knox provides a really cool perspective and history of the CAIC. So I would encourage people to go back and listen to that. But Ethan, I was hoping you could summarize some of the key turning points throughout the history of the CAIC.
Yeah, absolutely. Listening to that episode with Knox is something everybody should do. Really anything Knox says is worth listening to from my experience. So 1973 is when the Knox and Art Judson, as the Colorado Avalanche Warning Program, started daily forecasts in November of 1973. And that's where we sort of marked the beginning of the program. There is history before that, which just kind of briefly was the start of the Avalanche project in the Rocky Mountain Research Station, which is a branch of the Forest Service. And so that's, Pete Martinelli and a whole bunch of other scientists that, kind of built the foundation of avalanche work and knowledge in the United States. And Art Judson was part of that and really became interested in the forecasting and kind of public safety side, which didn't really exist in the United States at that point, and made connections with the folks at SLF in Switzerland, and then, eventually kind of started this program. And so that there was a bunch that sort of led up to that first period of daily forecasts. From there, I think another big transition was in 1983 when the Forest Service cut the funding for the program. And Knox was able to move it to the state government. So it joined the state of Colorado, the Department of Natural Resources. And a big part of why he was able to do that was because the Bureau of Reclamation was funding a cloud seeding program in the San Juan Mountains to try to look at essentially storing water in the San Juan Mountains. And people were worried about avalanches as they, as people were building, producing more snow in the mountains. And so Knox was really at the right place at the right time and was able to kind of recognize this opportunity and to keep the public safety avalanche program alive in Colorado. So that's when the program became the CAIC in the Department of Natural Resources. There was really no government funding for the program at that point. So Knox did an amazing job of keeping everything alive. And I think it was about 10 years later where he was actually able to get some base funding for the program and not just survive on donations and grants from these other agencies. So that was a pivotal piece. The start of the program with CDOT, so I think that was 92 or 93, when Knox and a guy named Ed Fink in the Department of Transportation in Colorado joined forces to start the avalanche safety program for the highways in Colorado. And so that started forecasting first in the San Juan Mountains, and then that kind of spread to all the other stretches of the roads in Colorado that are threatened by avalanches. Wolf Creek Pass, the Western Slope Office, areas around Leadville, Independence Pass, Monarch Pass, Eisenhower Tunnel, I-70, that kind of stuff. So that was a pivotal point. Transitioning from kind of these regional products to the 10 zones, forecast zones that we used for a long time, was another kind of pivotal piece. That happened in 2006, I believe. And then of course last year us moving to dynamic zones, and so not having fixed forecast zones is also maybe a pretty big landmark. I'm sure there's some other ones along the way. Knox starting the Colorado Snow and Avalanche Workshop, so the first regional workshop, which I think was in
2002.
2002? Yeah. I was going to say 2004, but 2002 might be right. I was working in Utah at that time and attended it. It was a pretty small room compared to what it is now. Yeah, so those are some of the highlights, I guess. I'm sure I'm forgetting some, but maybe that'll suffice.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ethan, maybe you could describe kind of the scope of avalanche hazard in Colorado, because it's pretty big, like between ski areas, backcountry users, roadways, and infrastructure. I mean, it's a significant natural hazard that affects humans, maybe more so than in any other state. You think that's fair to say?
Yeah, I think it is fair to say. I mean, I certainly don't want to diminish the impact that it has in other places, but there's a lot of mountains in Colorado, and there's a lot of people in the mountains in Colorado, and they're doing a lot of things, like you alluded to. And so I think that combination produces an impact of avalanches on people from workers, avalanche workers, people that are recreationally actively engaging avalanche terrain, to people that are really avoiding avalanche terrain, or even just trying to get to work. It really can impact people at lots of different parts of their lives, and that I think happens more so in Colorado on a large scale than probably the other Western states.
Mm-hmm. You know, Colorado accounts for a third of the avalanche fatalities in the U.S., right? Like that's just kind of a testament to perhaps the number of people out there.
Yeah. I mean, in order to get, fatal avalanche accidents, you need two things: people and avalanches. And Colorado has a lot of both. And with the ski areas, we have 27, major ski areas. We have, 30 sections of road that are affected by avalanches, over 500 avalanche paths affecting the state transportation system. And I think over 270 that are actively mitigated. And that doesn't include county roads. There's municipalities, occupied structures that are affected, a lot of utilities. And then you move into the backcountry, which is the source of most of the fatal accidents, in the last 70 years or so. There's a lot going on in this place.
Yeah, it must. I mean, like, what is that like trying to be the director of the Avalanche Center there? It's such a huge scope. Like, are you still out there digging pits and forecasting on a daily basis? Or like, what is the role of the director?
Yeah, it's a good question. It can encompass a lot of things. I am not writing forecasts anymore, and I haven't now for, I don't think I've been on the daily schedule for a while. Probably, it's at least 5 years. It might be more like seven. But when I started, I worked the desk just like everybody else. As we've grown in size, more staff, changing the personnel model, different types of roles, I've stepped out of that role. So I still, try to offer some advice. I think I try to stay out of the daily kind of forecast conversations as much as possible. Be there as a resource for people if they want my opinion. But I try not to offer it unless asked now. So I think, like, over the course of my career at the CAIC, I've gone from like being an active forecaster to being a guide, but being actively involved, to now, really trying to stay out of the fray and offer some context or opinion if necessary. But only when asked. So that's a pretty big change. I still do field work. I still support search and rescue operations. I still step in to support highway operations. I haven't written a backcountry avalanche forecast, I think, for a couple of years now. So there was times that I would still step in to help write those products. Now, if I'm stepping in to write something, it's probably more like social media or you know, editing reports, you know, things like that. So if I'm in the field, it's either supporting search and rescue or supporting highway operations for the most part. So, but my role, it's really quite varied. And I can end up doing a lot of different things on a particular day. You know, I do, over the last few years, I think I've really tried to be more of a support to the regional managers. Now we have a lead forecaster role, you know, and then we have, you know, just a general forecaster role. So I'm trying to support all those folks to do the work that they are trying to do rather than do the work for them.
How many forecasters are there between backcountry forecasters and highway forecasters in Colorado?
Well, let's see, we're a staff of 31 this year. We have a new role of these field technicians that are just doing observations. There's four of those. We have, I think, four additional support staff. Might only be three. So we're, you know, people that are in some sort of, you know, major forecast role, you know, we're in that 25 range, kind of right in there.
Yeah.
24 to 26, something like that.
Wow. It's a big staff. There must be some challenges associated with that in terms of like communication and maybe if you could give us a glimpse into kind of the daily flow of how that communication happens and collaboration across a pretty big distance, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're covering, you know, all the areas in Colorado, and I think that's about 50,000 square miles of terrain that we might issue a product for, and we're issuing products daily for somewhere in that 26 to 28 thousand square miles. And yeah, having a big group like this is challenging. You know, fortunately, we have a really good staff, and they make it easy in a lot of ways, just because they're you know, very professional and very focused, and you know, really goal oriented to try to serve the folks in Colorado as best they can. You know, we have a lot of sort of structures in place to help facilitate the communication, from stuff that's pretty formal to stuff that's informal, I guess. You know, going from the formal, you know, we have a daily meeting where people are, you know, really where the rubber meets the road, so to speak, figuring out what the hazard is and figuring out, you know, what the messages are, both to, you know, the maintenance workers for the highway and for the public, you know, any sort of communication outside of normal forecast, you know, social media, website updates, things like that needs to happen. There's a one person, a forecaster of the day, that is really kind of overseeing everything, and they run that meeting, and then everybody kind of, you know, goes out and creates their individual products. We have a series of kind of weekly meetings to cover different pieces, you know, kind of field work objectives and communication, you know, regional supervisors meetings, different groups. We're split into three regional groups. So even though we're, you know, this one big operation, we chop things into kind of smaller pieces. Those groups contain both highway and backcountry forecasters. And so they're, you know, collecting data, analyzing the avalanche hazard, and then, you know, breaking it up into the different applications that they need to. And so there's a regional manager for each one of those groups. There's a lead forecaster for each one of those groups. And then there's a series of highway or backcountry forecasters and field technicians that are in each of those groups. And then kind of into the less formal, well, we have, you know, like a bunch of ways of documenting people as they're coming onto shifts and going off of shifts, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, we have a bunch of running chats. The state of Colorado uses Google. So we have a whole bunch of Google chats that are kind of going 24/7. We started this year just a kind of a general social chat, sort of a water cooler. We call it the White Room. So you can go in there and, you know, throw up articles from from different organizations. I put in a book that I thought was going to be interesting for people to read. You know, we put in some media contacts so people could see some of the interviews folks were doing. We have a social media chat where we're collecting information that people can use for the different social media feeds. We have a general forecast chat. We have chats for different regional groups. Yeah, all that kind of stuff. And so those are, you know, pretty informal ways of circulating information kind of day to day. We have a bunch of Google groups that we use for kind of more formal communications that need to go out to different groups.
Pretty amazing how the speed of information sharing has evolved over time and affected avalanche forecasting in the industry as a whole.
Yeah, I think, you know, our industry, of course, is just a reflection of society in general. And, you know, the amount of information that we all move around is really impressive and daunting and at times a little scary.
Yeah, no doubt. One of the things that I think is pretty relevant right now is the strive for consistency amongst different avalanche centers in our messaging to the public, no matter what state or region you might be in. You know, and one of the things that makes the CAIC unique is the state funding and kind of like the separation from that federal funding. So the National Avalanche Center has kind of been a big driver of some of this consistency through a streamlined avalanche forecasting platform, which I think is great. What has CAIC done to help create that congruency with other avalanche centers as you are kind of a bit of a separate entity, but part of the whole?
Yeah, well, we work really closely with the National Center and have for years. And there's kind of an interesting evolution there. Some of the work that the National Center has done to bring the different avalanche centers together started as work that either we were doing internally in the CAIC or we were doing internally at the CAIC with their help and input, because the CAIC is about the same size as all the other Forest Service centers. And so we have the same problem that all the whole U.S. center collective, like we have that same problem within the CAIC, and we spent a lot of time just building our own consistency between, you know, different forecasters that didn't see each other every day, different situations, you know, the implementation of the conceptual model and the avalanche problem kind of paradigm, even just the avalanche danger scale. And so, you know, we had been working for a long time on how to provide that guidance and structure and training to build a consistent set of products that we would put out. And then the National Avalanche Center, started working on, well, they had been working with us on that. And then that started sort of spreading through the Forest Service centers. And I think, like you talked about, the platform that they've built and that a lot of the centers are using is the growth of that work. And it's been a huge and I think really effective step in all of that. So even though we're not working on that platform with them, we are working with them in terms of like data structure and a lot of the things that go into that platform we talk about and we try to share things and we try to do things together. This last summer, a group from the Forest Service Avalanche Centers and the National Center and us worked on a common layout to try to bring the products, the look of the baseline products, again, closer together. So, it's really just through collaboration and really over, you know, one of the first things I got tasked with, at the CAIC was working on the revamp of the danger scale, which was something that I really didn't want to do, but, the working group that had been built was essentially, you know, folks in Canada, a representative from the Forest Service in the U.S. and a representative from the CAIC. And so I sort of, you know, drew that short straw at that point. And since then, there's been a really concerted effort to try to build that consistency. And that's, you know, 20 years, really 20 years of work. And you can see the progress that we've made, which I think is substantial, but it is also a little daunting to see how much more work there is to do to both really make sure that we're communicating as an industry in a consistent and productive and effective way while still maintaining the ability for these different groups to be creative and try to address local needs and experiment and figure out new things. It's really, it's a very interesting process, and it's long and arduous and at times really rewarding. Yeah, well, it's one of the wonderful things about our industry is just how passionate people are about this stuff. And, you know, I think there needs to be kind of, with any sort of risk communication, and especially like a broad public safety effort. I mean, you can think about like, you know, public health efforts, you know, trying to get people to wear seatbelts or, you know, any of that stuff. Like, I think we need to look at ourselves in that light in a certain way and use some of the lessons that those folks have learned with, you know, bigger problems and more well-funded efforts. You know, we need to learn from that stuff, but we also need to keep the passion and the creativity and the stuff that this industry has created with the level of resources that it has is pretty impressive. And so, you know, balancing that I think is a real challenge, but also what makes it interesting.
So Ethan, you mentioned the dynamic forecast zones that were introduced last year. I was hoping you could explain to our listeners a little bit more about that, why it was implemented, and what are some of the implications for the end user of the forecast?
There's a lot in there. And so there's a lot of different facets of those ideas and how they're developed, how they're implemented, and kind of how it maybe sets us up, you know, in the future. I guess I'd like to start with the impacts on the end user, because I think in some ways that's the most important part. And this really goes a little bit into what will happen in the future. I think one of the really important parts of this is to present a clear path for people to get the information that they need. And so what we've been trying to do is leverage the other ways that we get information in our daily lives. And so, you know, Google Maps is sort of a good example, something that is hopefully, I think, ubiquitous in all of our experiences. And the way that you find information there is by, you know, putting a point on the map or typing in the name of the thing or the place that you want to go. And so from an end user's perspective, our hope is that that's what we're training people to do for avalanche information is, you know, think about trip planning, think about where you're going, what are you going to do? You know, type in that place name, you know, navigate it on a map to the spot that you're going to start your tour. You know, put down a pin and let us serve up the best information that we have for you from that point. So that I hope is the end user experience and perspective that we build for folks, that they don't have to worry about, you know, whether it's November or January, whether there's a lot of snow or a little snow, maybe they're doing a 14er in Colorado in July. Their experience can really be the same in any of those situations that they, you know, I'm going to climb the Mountain of the Holy Cross. You know, start by typing that in and we'll serve up the best information that we can. In order to do that, we we really needed to separate how the forecasters build the products from how the users consume them. And so that was a big part of this effort, you know, with Avalanche Canada, thinking about like, how was that process gonna happen? And so I think that also frees us up quite a bit, is that like, we don't have to retrain users about the geography when we change how we treat the geography as a forecasting operation. And so, you know, being able to break those three things apart and let the user experience, hopefully the user experience is static or doesn't change very quickly. It's, you know, type in your place name, put a pin on the map, and we have this whole ability to change on the back end how the forecasters look at the terrain, how they treat the terrain, how we collect, analyze, model all the features that we're interested in to produce products for folks. Does that make sense?
That was a great explanation. You know, I think there's an inherent flaw in like creating boundaries when we're talking about natural hazard, right? And like, and hopefully the end user isn't taking those boundaries too literally, right? Like, it's not like right when you cross over the line, you don't have a persistent slab problem anymore. Like, that's not how this problem works, right? So, it seems like that's addressing some of that.
Well, I think your point is spot on. As people that know about avalanches, that what you described of, you know, there's this line in the mountains and things are different on one side than the other. Like, we all know that that's not how things work. But there's a bit of a open question about whether our clients understand that or not. And so I think like there's other things that we try to do to sort of get that point across to people, because we don't want to rely on the fact that that is a given for them. It is for a lot of people, and hopefully it is for everybody, but I don't know if we can really, you know, hang our hat on that necessarily. And so that's why I think more of these ways of kind of communicating the spatial construct. And, you know, like the forecast zones, the fixed forecast zones that we all used for many, many years, like that's not a unusual way of addressing patterns in nature, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we see that there's tons of examples out there of people doing sort of similar things. But as our ability to analyze things and display things and communicate changes, you know, it's probably a pretty reasonable thing to move away from just because of what you said of that that's not how nature works. As information technology has grown, like there's more and more examples of us kind of putting more detail and moving away from that, but starting with those sort of fixed zones. But even from sort of an accessibility perspective to this type of information, like if you came to Colorado, you know, 10 years ago, you would have to learn the 10 forecast zones that we were using. It was a construct that for people that looked at the avalanche forecast every day, I mean, it was what we all lived and breathed it. But it was a construct that didn't exist for anything else. It wasn't in your weather forecast. It wasn't in your national forests. It wasn't in your where your trails were. It was unique to avalanche information. And so in order to get good avalanche information, you needed to understand, you needed to learn this whole new way of looking at the mountains of Colorado that just didn't exist anywhere else. And so that's, again, from that user experience, hopefully something that we're moving away from, like the barrier to accessing and understanding that information, like anything that we can do to lower that, I think, is an important thing to try to do. It doesn't mean that we don't have lots of other information that's more detailed in there that you need to know a lot about the mountains or about avalanches in general to interpret, but making the entry point as easy as possible I think is something that that we tried to do in this particular sense. So then we have this, we start with this sort of user experience of, you know, typing in a place name, putting a point on the map, we'll serve up the best information. How we create and what the level of detail and the all of the stuff that we know about the information that we can serve to people, like that changes throughout the year. And it changes, you know, as we move from summer to fall into to winter, both in terms of our confidence and how much we can dice things up and in terms of the complexity of the avalanche conditions throughout the area that we're dealing with. And so the dynamic zones allow us to try to represent that based on what we know and what we think is happening. That's not akin, it's not fixed in this one particular paradigm. It allows us to make really general products for the summertime that are, you know, basic avalanche safety, and to chop things into, you know, 20, 30, who knows how many different, you know, forecast areas that we'll get to in the middle of the winter when things are complicated.
Yeah. And what's the feedback been from the end user? Like y'all started this last year. I know you're a pretty data-driven person. Like is the data showing or just anecdotal feedback showing that this is effective for the end user?
I don't know if we really have very good data to show a change in the effectiveness. You know, the anecdotal data, the feedback that we got was overwhelmingly positive. There's definitely a group of people that, I think it was a transition. So, it seemed confusing to start with, but the more that they used it and saw how we were using it, I think that they saw the benefit. A little bit of the feedback was masked last year because we got rid of our email service, because creating email lists for these dynamic zones is something that we could do, but it's a lot harder than email list for static zones. And so, you know, based on some research, we decided that we weren't going to invest in that. And so most of the comments that we got last year on the forecast were people that were upset that they didn't get emails anymore. So that, that may have masked any of the other signals that we were looking at. It has changed the accuracy of our forecasts a little bit. But when we're looking at that, we only have 1 year to compare to multiple years. And so it's really hard to put a whole lot of stock in that yet. I think that the effect on the accuracy is going to be interesting because, you know, obviously if you have more places to write predictions for, there's a greater chance of you getting something wrong. But also the ability to move the boundaries around hopefully allows us to make more well-defined statements about specific areas. Like one of the things that we would always see with the fixed zones is you have a, you know, a big zone running north-south and the north part of the zone is getting hit by a storm and the south is not. You know, we can now break those into pieces and hopefully do a better job. So how that impacts, how those competing factors impact forecast accuracy over time will be an interesting thing to look at.
Hmm. So the way that forecasters engage with the public has certainly evolved over time in leaps and bounds with technology and social media. I've got a listener question here. Bobot, I'm sorry, I don't know your full name, but Instagram user Bobot wants to know, do you think it would be a good idea for avalanche centers to share their gaps in knowledge or uncertainty with public observers in order to gain the public observers' targeted observations around these gaps in knowledge? You know, like, does that open up too big of a door, or is that something that, like, you think is appropriate for forecasters to engage with the public about, like, hey, like we're not certain on, you know, trends around this persistent weak layer, you know, identifying that uncertainty from the forecaster side and then kind of leaning on the public to get more information about it. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's an interesting idea for sure. You know, we've tried some things like that, but not like a formal product that, you know, where we were saying, you know, this is what we want. We have put requests in forecasts for certain information in certain areas. And so that's sort of an informal way that we've done that. The part that I guess gives me a little pause is that we, and I think a lot of the other Avalanche centers, maybe all of them, have spent a lot of time trying to get people to send us information. And I know specifically in Colorado, because of the length of the program and the evolution of information collection and sharing, there was a period when I worked here early on where you know, people didn't send us information because they felt like they weren't knowledgeable enough. You know, they, you know, you needed lots of training and you had to carry a lot of thermometers and shear frames or something into the field in order to collect information. And so we've spent a lot of time trying to convince people that we want to hear from them really regardless of what they are seeing. You know, pictures are better than, you know, avalanche codes. You know, snow pits are great, but, you know, just tell us how much it snowed even. You know, tell us if you haven't seen avalanches. And so we spend a lot of time trying to just cultivate any type of information and reduce the barrier for people to give us information. Sending out like a list of like really targeted, you know, more technical obs is something that, you know, we could easily do, but it's sort of in contrast to that, you know, more community-based, you know, everything is worthwhile. We want to hear from everybody. And so figuring out how to balance that, I think, would be the challenging part. You know, with the new role that we have in the center in the staffing this year with these field technicians, that's part of what we're doing with one of our weekly meetings is really talking about the specific areas and the specific types of information that we want to try to collect just as a staff. And so it's an interesting idea to try to put that out to the public in some way. But again, we'd have to figure out like how those two different messages would relate and not work against each other.
Yeah. And I think for the kind of savvy, curious backcountry traveler that wants to contribute in that way, like a good way to do that is to reach out to your local forecaster and start conversations with them and, you know, make them aware that you're out there and are willing to help and kind of start some of these side conversations to add to your local forecast, right? Get engaged.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's lots of ways to, like you said, to reach out to your local forecaster and kind of start that dialogue, whether it's social media or you know, emails or for old school folks, the telephone. And even if you don't have guidance from them, I'll tell you that any forecaster, you know, more information is better. So anything that you see, whether it's, you know, lots of avalanches or you traveled in a bunch of terrain and didn't see any avalanches, all of that is really useful information for your local forecaster.
Yeah. So Ethan, another aspect of the CAIC is the database of avalanche accidents that the CAIC houses. So that's pretty much the national database there. There's a lot of sadness in these accident reports, right? Like they hit home for a lot of us. But there's also the potential for much insight to be gained by reading about accidents. Whether you're going through the accident database, which everybody should check out, or whether you've bought a copy of the Snowy Torrents, which is a little bit more of like a readable version of these accidents. I know that you've spent a lot of time poring over accident reports, being part of accident investigations. What do you feel like are some salient trends or factors that you've learned from reviewing accidents?
You talked about the sadness in them, and yeah, I mean, all of these accidents are pretty traumatic. The fatal accidents are pretty traumatic events. Even the involvements can have pretty severe impact on people. But the fatal accidents really ripple out into the community in a lot of different ways, and so that is a hard thing to see, and a hard thing to see over and over again. As far as, you know, accident trends, I think you actually captured it pretty well in terms of there's something to be gained and learned from reading in detail these individual reports. I think that you're likely to get more out of them if you can see the similarities between yourself and the people involved, rather than looking at the differences. And I would say that regardless of whether it's you're a snowmobiler and it's a skier, or it's in a place that you don't know or a place that you do know well, or it's with a big group and you always travel in a small group, or vice versa. Like, there's always some way that you can kind of see a similarity. And the ones that, are sort of scariest to me, I think, are the ones where there's a lot of similarities. But in each one of these, I think I try to look at, what can I learn out of this? What can I apply to myself and my own experience? And then, the database, allows us to kind of look at trends. And I think, there's a real difference between the U.S. and the Colorado data set in terms of what we can do with the trends and some of the stuff that, we've worked on with Carl Berkland and Eric Peitsch on kind of looking at the national trend are, with Eric, the changes in the age group of people that are getting killed in avalanches. I think, the work that he did there was quite interesting. And then, with Carl, really just looking at the number of accidents, over time. And I think there is some encouraging results there, just that I think anybody that you talk to in the Western U.S. Would tell you that the number of people out in the backcountry is increasing. And even though we don't know that number, I think we have a pretty good handle on that number is increasing and has increased dramatically. And yet the number of fatal accidents is pretty consistent or even slightly downward trending throughout the states. And I think that really bolsters the work of everybody that's working in avalanche safety, whether you're teaching classes, whether you're, forecasting for a public group, whether you're, forecasting at a ski area or a highway, or if you're just a backcountry user, you're involved in, using that information and applying it into the field. And as a community, all of those folks and more together, we're keeping the accident rate relatively flat, which is great. I would love to see the number of accidents go to zero. And I think that's going to be a hard thing to do, just because, again, of the number of people involved, and we're dealing with this natural hazard that really is very complicated and manifests itself in very different ways. And how, when you have people in avalanches interacting together, it's just even more complicated. And I think through the accidents that I've looked at, I am amazed at the size of avalanches, how large avalanches people can get involved in and survive, and how small of avalanches people can get killed in.
Yeah, that's some good insight, Ethan. I really enjoyed seeing Brian Lazar and Laura McGladdery's kind of presentation at ISSW on what the CAIC is doing with their stress resiliency program. Maybe you could kind of summarize that and talk about what was involved. How was the buy-in from your staff and why was this implemented?
It's implemented because I think it's really important. I think a lot of groups of first responders and avalanche workers, we were not aware of how the dealing with these different events was impacting us. And before we started working with Laura, we were working just within the state government to try to provide some support from people. And we started doing that because a couple of people asked for help and because we had the opportunity, I guess. And so we sort of started with the mental health benefits that you have as a state worker. And those are both, you know, part of your, you know, medical insurance package, but there's also, it doesn't really work very well for us, but there is a program where you can, you know, get some different types of coaching and guidance and mental health pieces.
Like an employee assistance program or something.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. Because the CAC is part of the Department of Natural Resources, one of the biggest pieces of the Department of Natural Resources is Colorado Parks and Wildlife. And the Parks and Wildlife group is essentially, or a large part of what they do is law enforcement. And so they had started to provide some first responder mental health support to the, you know, through the kind of law enforcement program. And so, you know, we started kind of using them and learning from their folks on that. Ian Fowler, who's one of the forecasters at the center, he came to the center and he had come from, you know, he's a guide, but it was also a ski patroller at Eldora Ski Area and had worked with Laura on a resiliency program there. And he was the one who really sort of got us thinking about like how to, should we implement something that was, you know, a little bit more well thought out, a little bit better coordinated. And so he and Brian started working with GLAAD and really put this program together. I think at the same time, you know, Laura was interested in doing something for the avalanche community. She had gotten requests and, you know, like Drew Hardesty and other folks were really, had seen this need sort of like we had, and everybody was sort of talking in different ways. And so she was really interested in like coordinating with, you know, she'd worked with the Monarch Ski Patrol and the Eldora Ski Patrol and was really interested in kind of working with us. And so the three of them really kind of built the program and then, you know, worked with the Snowmass Ski Patrol as well to try to implement things in kind of different ways and look at how these different programs might implement it. The buy-in for us, I think, was actually better than I expected. you know, I think everybody or most people, you know, were leery of another process, you know, another thing that they had to do. You know, were we going to have to, people going to be forced to talk through things that they didn't want to talk about? You know, how is it going to manifest for individuals? And I think that that Laura and Ian and Brian did a really nice job of sort of building something that everybody participates in, but it's really flexible and it allows you to go from sort of an anonymous comment about something to when we have an exposure, you know, we have a protocol that we go through to sort of see whether we want to try to provide more support you know, it allows the individual that's exposed to the traumatic event to kind of break away from all the other things that they're doing and think about if it's impacting them or not. And it can be, you know, very simple and, you know, without much follow-up, or it can trigger a follow-up that could lead to the implementation of a lot of resources or just a check-in over time. And so I think that flexibility of it is really what has worked well for folks. And I think that the group in general has come to see it as a really useful thing. So, you know, just in kind of a brief overview, like, you know, we have a monthly check-in and it's anonymous and Ian kind of gives a summary to the group of like, how's everybody doing? You know, and there's some general questions in there about how you're doing, but then also some ways that you can, you know, ask for help or point out, you know, some places where other folks in the organization need to kind of think about things. And then when we have some sort of exposure, you know, we have a little form that we fill out that helps us think about that exposure and how it's impacted us. And you talk about it with another member of the group. And then if you have a enough of an impact, if you know, if you've sort of calculated your impact and it reaches a certain threshold, then we, you know, we start to check in with people, you know, after 3 days, after 3 weeks, after 3 months. And then again, that can steer you into where we actually use some of those employee benefits that we talked about and set you up with, you know, a mental health professional, even just you know, a quick chat or something more prolonged, or not. And we just, you know, kind of check in with people. But that structured framework, those check-ins, either detailed or very casual, I think all of that together, you know, has turned into a nice support network for the staff.
Yeah, it seems like it. And it seems like this is super scalable to most any operation out there. And I know Brian and Laura, you know, said at ISSW that if you want to find out more, they're happy to share this and some things that have worked well for your organization. So thanks for being a leader in some of that work, in implementing that amongst your team. It's really important and much needed, I think, within our industry. Just a couple other listener questions to throw out to you, Ethan. Here's a fun one. What's your favorite snow grain or snow crystal?
Oh, how do you choose your favorite child? Well, you know, I did my PhD looking at facets growing around ice crusts. So that it's not really one particular ice grain, but that combination is something that has fascinated me, and I've spent a lot of time looking at, you know, really any sort of, you know, faceted or growing ice crystal, you know, just the number of ways that they grow and the shapes that they build, you know, I think are fascinating. So I can look at them kind of endlessly. So, but really all, it's hard to pick one. Machine-made snow, I think may be lower on the list, but it's still kind of fascinating to see like what kind of you know, shapes come out of those machines. So
yeah, here's another one. Do you think you can work in the snow science avalanche forecasting field without a degree?
Of course, I think there's lots of people doing that. You know, it really just depends on what you want to do and how you want to approach it. I don't think that you can do, any job, you know, certainly if you want to, you know, teach at a major university, and do research on, snow and avalanches, you know, those degrees are going to be important. But there's lots of other jobs that you can do without a degree. And, you know, I have been fortunate enough to work with some really good avalanche professionals that didn't have advanced degrees, or some of them maybe not even undergrad degrees. There's a lot of ways to get into this industry and to work and succeed in this industry. I think education is really helpful and really important, but it's not the only way to get things done.
Yeah, great answer. Okay, last listener question, and this is a good one. What do you think is the greatest challenge facing the avalanche industry right now?
Well, as usual, I don't see the avalanche industry necessarily as monolithic. So it kind of depends. I guess when I think avalanche industry, I think more sort of the workforce, and, you know, just some kind of big challenges are you know, compensation, diversity of workforce, consistency in training. You know, I think those are all really important issues. Safety, worker safety, I think is a really big issue. You know, as far as like an avalanche center, I think the demands, the number and the range of demands on our time or opportunities for us to to try to make progress on our mission is really kind of daunting. It's wonderful. It's a great challenge. But it gets exhausting sometimes, like the amount of work that people put into trying to address different people and groups' needs, trying to understand opportunities that when people come to us with some great idea, whether it's going to work, you know, trying to take some new idea from a different industry, a different technology and apply it. Like there's so many things that we can do. There's so many things that we are doing, and you know, it's just hard to stay on top of all of that. I don't want a bigger organization necessarily, but you know, I could easily employ twice as the number of people that we have right now.
Yeah, right on. Ethan, a little tip of the hat to the friends of the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. Could you do your work without the friends?
No, we could not run the program that we are running right now without the work of the friends of the CAIC. And that's in a lot of ways. It's you know, financial is a big part of it. Like the money that they raise that goes to our budget is essential for the program that we have right now. But they're also you know, doing community outreach. You know, the Trailhead program that they're running now. They have a mobile classroom that they're taking around the state to talk to people. The joint work that the two programs, the CAIC and the Friends of the CAIC, do together is tremendous and could not be done without both groups.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, Ethan, I won't take up any more of your time. I know you're a busy person and you've got a lot on your plate. So I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking about the, especially the dynamic forecast zones. I think that's a super cool topic, and glad to see it's going well for you all. So thank you so much. Appreciate all of your contributions to the Snow and Avalanche Arena. And yeah, it's been great chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. And yeah, it was in the conversation. It was really, really nice talking to you. And yeah, I hope some of our conversations helpful for your audience and the rest of the avalanche industry. And, you know, please, people, reach out to us at the Colorado Avalanche Information Center if there's something we can do to help you, if you have a question or some idea that's going to consume us for the next 5 or 10 years.
All right. Well, have a great winter out there, Ethan. Hope to see you on the skin track soon.
Sounds good.
Cheers.
Well, that was a great conversation with Ethan Green. Thank you, Ethan, for joining us here on the Avalanche Hour podcast, and thank you all for listening. This podcast is all about sharing stories, knowledge, and news. So if you have suggestions or questions for future episodes, please contact us. You can do that on our website at www.theavalanchehour.com, where you can also find all our past episodes. You can also reach out at theavalanchehourpodcast@gmail.com. You can find the Avalanche Hour Podcast on Facebook and Instagram at The Avalanche Hour Podcast. If you've been enjoying the podcast, tell a friend. Please rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Those 5-star reviews on Apple Podcasts really help spread the show. If you want to help support the podcast, there's a new donate button on theavalanchehour.com. Thank you to everyone who's supported the show so far. Our artwork was created by Mike T. Thanks, Mike. Music for this episode was written and performed by Gravy. Thanks, Gravy, for the tunes. You can hear more of Gravy's tunes at gravy.tunes on Instagram and find his album on Bandcamp. This episode was produced by Caleb Merrill.